Welcome to the Reaction podcast. I'm Ian Martin, editor of Reaction, and I'm joined by my esteemed colleague, Maggie Pagano, executive editor of Reaction. And there's tons to catch up on, Maggie. We're going to talk about what happened in Scotland. We're going to talk a bit about the mess that the Labour Party and Keir Starmer are in, and Boris, of course. But when we both just watched the Boris press conference, fresh from his extraordinary success in last week's elections, and it looks as though the reopening is on track. I say on track, but it's all very slow. Do you think they're doing the right thing, the pace in which the reopening's happening?
Do you know, I struggle with this, but I, from a political point of view, from Boris's point of view, I can see why he's sticking to the roadmap, because I think he was burnt very badly about the criticism last year of being slow. And I sense that that haunts him. And in a sense, if he can't be blamed, if by being cautious, he cannot be blamed for a new outbreak. And I think the fact in 6 months' time, people will forget whether it was May the 17th, May the 30th or June the 21st. So in a sense, and it's been quite traumatic. I think a lot of people are going to take some time to get back to normal. Although, am I allowed to say this? I was in London yesterday for the first time in 14 months, and it seemed like, you know, life was back to normal. So I think erring on the side of caution is the right political decision. And in a sense, it's up to people to sort of do their own thing, isn't it? Obviously a struggle for businesses. Yeah. But that's my conclusion.
Yeah. I suppose the only troubling part of it all was, and it is impressive now when you see how the communication works and the way in which, because they've done so well with the vaccine rollout, Britain's in a really good position, and the comms, it was a good message that they were selling, but they just, compared to a year ago, you just look how on top of things they look, with Whitty and Valance being very convincing.
Yeah.
But there was just that concern about what's been deemed the Indian variant, and obviously the Kent strain, the good old-fashioned English strain is the dominant strain, but they do seem to be, they flagged, and there's been a lot of concern about this online. They flagged that they are worried that that there's a rate of increase there, which is concerning them. Still a small number of cases. They didn't really, and I haven't read anything much that I find convincing on it yet, or that explains it very clearly. They, if those cases are taking off, should we worry about that? Because, well, we're moving into summer, which naturally should improve things. And what's the potential in terms of, you know, breakout from the from the vaccines? Does this mean that the vaccines are less effective? Don't know. But so that was the one thing that they flagged up. Other than that, it seemed to be good news. May the 17th, back to something closer to reality, actually being able to eat inside in restaurants and that sort of stuff. And then it's amazing how they've conditioned us all, haven't they? You think like June the 21st is still a long way away, but we're all very very obedient. Just on Boris's success last week, which leads us into Labour, Maggie, and the mess that Labour's in. And it is interesting, isn't it, the way everything focuses on Labour's screw up, as though Labour lost the elections, which of course is a factor. But the Tories also last week, and we're talking primarily about England here, the Tories won it as well as Labour losing it, didn't they?
They certainly did, and it's been sort of disguised by the absolute mess that Labour find themselves in. And I think the most striking results were Ben Hoochin in Teesside and Andy Street in the West Midlands. I mean, I know that Labour also won some very good mayoralties, but the fact is that these were heartland traditional Labour areas, regions for what, donkey's years. You had a Labour MP standing against Andy Street. And I think what's so interesting about both those characters, they're almost apolitical in what they've done. You know, they've they both invented leveling up before any of us heard of it, and by doing some very basic structural changes, brought jobs, brought transport. You know, Ben Hoochin actually raised the money to get the airport, Andy Street's open railway lines. This is not just guff. This is not just rhetoric. People can see it on the ground and they've responded. And I think that, if anything, and I read somewhere that apparently Starmer was more disappointed by Teesside than he was by Hartlepool. The other striking point about Hartlepool was that although Labour had been in power there for 30 years, people were actually blaming, and the Tories have supposedly run an austerity government, people were blaming the local Labour MP and councils for a lot of the problems there with hospitals and so forth. And again, it's what people are seeing on the ground. That's quite an interesting shift, isn't it?
Yeah. It's very interesting the way in which clips, vox pops, and interviews with voters where they were talking as though the Labour Party had been in power in Westminster for the last 11 years, which of course it's not. It's been a Conservative government. I think that does, though, underline one of the reasons or the explanations for Boris's success is that the voters that he's winning over do clearly see him as representing a break with Theresa May and David Cameron before that. It's not as though he's a continuity of, he's not just a continuity figure. He is regarded as a new government, a different approach. It allows him to be the incumbent who's winning by campaigning on the Time for a Change ticket, which is usually the preserve of new. I mean, I think he's Bruce Anderson wrote a piece for us on the site today, and Bruce has long been a critic of Boris, having worked with him years ago at Spectator, but just acknowledging, as he put it, Boris is a phenomenon. It's in England. It's incredible what's been achieved. Though one writer who's hopefully writing something for us in the next couple of days on all of this does make the point to me that actually, should we think about it in the following terms? If a government is winning in this way midterm, is that a good thing? Or is this the point at which in the electoral cycle and the economic cycle, and I know this is skewed by the pandemic, but is this the point at which a government should be doing really difficult stuff? Because it turns out that if you spend hundreds of billions of pounds at enormous speed and make loads of promises to people about levelling up, and money's seems to be limitless at the moment, it turns out that's massively popular. Before the bills land, of course, but I'm not seeking.
No, I agree, and I think
snippy about it just for the sake of it. I'm just flagging up that I think it's an interesting perspective. It's not quite as straightforward. I mean, what is the government doing that's really tough? Yes, of course, they're handling the pandemic, and that's a really difficult task. I get that, but in terms of tough decisions, there are no tough decisions being taken on spending, are there?
Quite the reverse. They're throwing money around. But going back to your earlier point, you're right. Boris is like a new government, represents a new government with new promises and quite a different set of targets and ambitions to previous Tory. I mean, this is a total reversal of free market economics. This is industrial intervention on a scale we haven't seen before. So he's going to be judged by that. And I think voters will be very brutal if he doesn't deliver it. And going back to the mayors, we can see that you can, if you use the right levers, you can actually deliver some pretty effective. And I think, who was it who wrote for us that one of the, and there's no question that Boris excites voters. He was up in Hartlepool on Friday and he needs to go back in 3 months' time. It's really, can Boris and his team, can they sustain this sort of level of energy? And he's got a lot to prove, hasn't he? So hopefully he will.
We'll see. What about the mess that Labour have got themselves into? I mean, I was very focused on the Scottish end of things, being Scottish and caring so much about the Union. But over the weekend, you know, that was all eclipsed by what happened in the Labour Party. I think I now understand a bit better what happened with the Rayner thing, which seemed a very odd thing of Starmer to do, to immediately try and fire Rayner. But it does look as though he tried to initiate a discussion with her about moving, and that her team or supporters preempted all of that by de facto, kind of in media terms, declaring war on the leader. And she's ended up with, well, I'm not, what has she ended up with? Is it a
three jobs?
Yeah, she's ended up with three jobs. But he can't really be said to have handled it well, can he?
No, and why would you? I mean, we don't know what happened behind the scenes and whether she's gone against him, because clearly, as campaign director and coordinator, she was obviously partly responsible for the hash of Hartlepool.
But it doesn't seem to accept that or acknowledge that. I mean, it's quite different. Her response, or the response of her supporters, is quite different to Annalise Dodds, who's been moved and sidelined, you know, shadow chancellor who didn't really make an impact, and just has taken it and accepted that is the case. Mm. Whereas Rayner seemed to see this as war rather than acknowledging her role in what was a pretty disastrous set of results.
Is that because she's got her own agenda, and that actually she's very ambitious? So if she thinks the heart and soul of the party has been lost, then declaring war now on Starmer sets her up to have a go at taking over from him. But just going back to the very beginning, which said, surely what they would have done is announced, you know, these are disastrous results. We got some good ones, but overall it was awful. We will go away and talk about what it is what's the purpose of the Labour Party? Why should people vote for us? You would have expected a little humility, or at least the start of a, you know, as people put it, the conversation about why it was people in Hartlepool were able to say, you know, despite 10 years of Tory austerity, it's Labour's fault, or why they have no connection with them anymore. You know, this is a moment for the Labour Party to really look at who it is, who is their voter. Is it still, you know, is it a nostalgic thing to talk about the working class, which people keep going on about? Or is it Angela Rayner wearing leopard skin trousers and bother boots, which some people have said is one of the things that annoyed Keir Starmer. You know, so
I think it's fair to say they're not a natural fit, Starmer and Rayner. I mean, to play devil's advocate for a moment, there were also some really positive things that happened for Labour. You mentioned some of the mayoralty questions, but Labour also did really well in Wales.
Yep.
So if you think of Labour coming back at some, and to me it seems absolutely obvious, if you want a non-Tory government at some point, the lesson of, you know, British politics in the last 100 years or so is, or since the death of the Liberals, is that there are two great organising forces, coalitions of interest. One is the Conservative Party, which does it primarily in England, and the other is the Labour Party, which has been able to draw on Wales, Scotland, the north of England, and then one when it's been able to create, when it's been able to convince sufficient voters in other parts of the UK to give Labour a go. And that's been the model. I just don't see all this talk on the left of a different approach to opposition, because the Greens are surging a bit, and that somehow there'll be this sort of rainbow alliance. That means you get the Tories forever. I would say is, if you want a non-Tory government and you want to save the Union longer term, then a revival in the fortunes of the Labour Party, and also just if you're just interested in healthy opposition for its sake and don't think that governments should have things all their own way because it's unhealthy, history demonstrates that very clearly. you need the Labour Party to get its act together, which is a very, very long way from doing. But I just flagged that if you're thinking of it in terms of the potential longer term revival of the Labour Party, what happened in Wales is very positive for them. Sarwar in Scotland didn't perform very well in the election, but did perform well in the campaign and had only been there for 2 months and made a really positive impression. So if you take Sarwar, Drakeford, who turns out to be much more impressive in Wales than people thought, the other successes you mentioned, Cairn won not by the massive landslide that people anticipated, but it did win. I'm playing devil's advocate here, but there is the heart of it all, just a big problem and a problem of personality, I think, with Starmer.
Do you not think it's something deeper than that? Because of course we all as Democrats want a healthy, vibrant, dynamic opposition, but I don't think they know what to oppose, and that's the heart of it. Because if Boris says we're going to increase the police forces on the beat by 20,000, 40,000 new nurses, $1 trillion on going green, furlough forever, what does Starmer come back on to beat him at that? At the moment, he seems to be torn between the sort of urban identity value. I'm not overdoing the woke thing, but that identity rather than values of, there are still people who live in poverty and in not good conditions who I would call still the working class, but he doesn't seem to speak to them anymore. They're not talking about, we shouldn't have zero contracts. We need to reform welfare. They haven't had that debate. And what is interesting, and I was talking to somebody earlier today, is there is a very strong wing of the Labour Party, represented by Paul Mason and others, who do believe in the sort of end of work, that it will all become technological, AI, and then you have universal basic income. And I think perhaps we don't realise there's some very strong factions there. And if you notice, Angela Rayner's third title was the future of work, not Minister for Work, but the future of work. So I think they're working out their own who they should be appealing to and what for.
Yeah, but what do you make of Starmer's personality in all of this? Oh. Because people like to look at, we all like to, political media class, consider this in terms of great ideological shifts, and you mentioned AI and the future of work and policy and all of that. Quite a bit of it, doesn't it? It just comes down to the personality of leaders. And in England, large numbers of voters, probably a majority, just like Boris, have, as people say, priced in his shortcomings. And there's something about his approach that they find amusing and authentic. And that's just the reality. Labour stuck with someone who I thought when the crisis started, I thought Starmer would be quite well positioned, that you might move back to an era where people would be interested in something technocratic, and he's a prosecutor.
He doesn't connect. No. Now I have the dinner party or go to the pub test. Who would you rather have a pint with? Boris or Keir Starmer? He's just quite cold. I don't even sense what he's like. You might not like Boris, well, a lot of people don't, but you could probably have a good debate with him, good conversation, whereas Keir just, I'm sure he's delightful, in private life, but it doesn't come across. Charisma bypass, I'm afraid.
Well, so Andrew Sullivan, the Brit writer based in the US who was at school with Keir Starmer, sings his praises. But whether as a humane, amusing person that he's still connected to, and a good bloke, but there are plenty of others who say different. But whether that's true or not in private, it's just really tough if you can't communicate that. If it doesn't come through the TV screen and you don't seem natural and likable, then it's very difficult to teach. So, you know, for the first time at the weekend, I started to think, is he stuffed? And I know some commentators have been writing this for months. I hadn't thought that he was. I thought pandemic politics is so, politics has been so disrupted during the pandemic that a leader of the opposition hasn't been able to go out and make speeches, go around the country, even meet his team properly. So he's been very constrained. So, I thought he deserved some, that he'd get a bit of extra time, but maybe you're just at that point where people have just decided he's not going to be prime minister, and the inability to fire Angela Rayner, just that sense of not that tons and tons of voters will be tuning into the minutiae of the Labour reshuffle, just the broad impression is chaotic and not strong leader.
Yeah. I think it will be a fight, won't it? It will be a fight between the Rayner wing and their future of work, or it will be someone like Burnham, who I know you think he's a bit of a softie, but again, like the other mayors, he's shown he can deliver, and he's got, you know, he looks quite fun. You probably would want to go to the pub with him. Very much so. Or Lisa Nandy. I think there is sort of... Labour people
have done so. Had dinner with him in nice restaurants back in the day when New Labour very New Labour thing to go to nice restaurants with journalists. But no. He's an interesting character. The way in which he's rebuilding by having gone to Manchester, I would question whether he's the kind of personality that. That large numbers of voters, for example, in the south of England, would vote for. I have
Burnham.
Could be wrong. Yeah.
Ten times more than for Starmer. He's just sort of fun, authentic, says what he means. He's got a story to tell. I think that's the difference. Starmer doesn't have a story to tell. Burnham has a story. And actually, it was great that he didn't get it before, because this would be, if he should have a go, this would be the making of him.
I can think of several reaction subscribers, quite a few actually, who cannot stand the bloke, who see his persona as sort of endlessly kind of mawkish and sentimental. I don't think remember that phase with reopening and stuff in the pandemic? I thought his handling of that was ludicrous. But
I agree with that. Grandstanding.
Yeah, exactly. So
I'm not giving in my view, by the way. I'm saying how I think he will be perceived. Let's move on to Scotland. You tell me about Scotland. What is going to happen?
Just very quickly on Labour then. So if Starmer falls, I mean, there isn't any indication he's going to have to go, but say there was a leadership contest or something happened. So what are Labour's options then? So Labour's options are, well, Burnham's not in the House of Commons. Who else have they got?
Lisa Nandy? Did you have another go?
Lisa Nandy, Yvette Cooper. Yvette Cooper is really, but again, there's the Brexit question. But I think Yvette Cooper is such an interesting politician, the way that she's developed in recent years and grown. So I would, keep an eye on Yvette Cooper. You wanted to talk about Scotland then. Has something happened in Scotland?
Yes, we want to know. We have a national referendum, not just a Scottish referendum. I'm now moving. I think we should campaign. They're part of the union. Why shouldn't everybody in the union have a view?
Extremely dangerous. I've always, as a Scottish unionist, I've always believed that England should never get a vote on this, because I know what the answer would be.
English
would demand that the Scots leave as quickly
I think so. Most of the people I know now are saying, well, they want to go. Let them go.
Yeah.
For that reason,
it must never be allowed.
So, I mean, she didn't get a majority, or absolute majority. She depends on the Greens. She said to people that they could vote for her even if they didn't want independence because she would concentrate on COVID. Clearly nonsense. Yeah. The first thing that she said was that she declared war on Boris. Tell me the legal. They can pass legislation now calling for a referendum bill.
Yes. There is so much rubbish talked about this. And what was clear over the weekend was that the nationalists want the story to be Boris is taking Scotland to court, and that Boris is using the people of Scotland have voted for a referendum, even though, as you said, she encouraged people who don't necessarily want a referendum. And the polling is clear. People certainly don't want a referendum, not for the next couple of years. But she wants to frame this because, as the SNP always does, to set this up in terms of conflict between Westminster and Scotland and between Boris and Scotland, because in those terms, she wins. What happens effectively is that the Scottish Parliament, which, as you say, has an SNP Green majority, will pass a bill at some point. I mean, it voted towards the end of the last session. There was a majority for Scottish referendum in the previous Parliament. But they'll pass a bill, and then Sturgeon will hold a press conference and say, under the Section 30 procedure, I'm writing a letter to the Prime Minister demanding that he opens negotiations on holding a referendum. At that point, he will say no. And for all that there'll be a lot of strutting about and a lot of shouting, that is, unless she decides to go for a wildcat referendum and a legal referendum, that will be the end of it, other than that she will keep hammering the idea that Scotland is being denied. If she was to then press ahead without the approval of the UK government, and it's absolutely central, this, the devolution settlement is designed in the way it was, not by accident. It requires the consent of the UK government, and there is no indication the UK government is going to allow a referendum, particularly when she failed to get an overall majority. Now, people say to me, why does that matter? Because you've got you have the Greens as well. The precedent was set, and the British Constitution relies on precedent a lot. Precedent was set in 2011 when the SNP themselves got an overall majority on a clear commitment, and Salmond opened talks with Cameron, and Cameron gave too much actually to the SNP in terms of setting the question. So that precedent does not apply now. The SNP has not got its overall majority. It depends for its majority in the parliament on some list seats from the ludicrous Greens. So the first test has not been passed, the precedent of 2011, and the Scottish government the UK government is not going to give its consent. And at the moment, it's saying not yet, but I would say that's pretty much it for the next 5 years. There will be a lot of shouting about it, but there won't be a referendum this side of 2026. I think what that does is it gives an unionist, I mean, it is a very impressive victory. The SNP's now won, has been the largest party in, you know, four elections on the trot in Scotland. When you consider what she was up against in terms of the Salmond trial, at one point it looked like you come close to bringing her down. She still ended up as the largest party, but just short of the overall majority. But it does, as I said, it buys some time for unionists to try and think how longer term make the case for the union, rebuild or recalibrate the union in a way which means this doesn't keep happening. It gives Labour a little bit of time to try and rebuild, and rebuild in the UK and rebuild in Scotland. And unionists can think, what is the strategy? I think Gordon Brown is talking about the need for increased cooperation. I think he's right on that. There needs to be, Boris Johnson's already moved with his letter to Sturgeon, attempting to invite her to various meetings. That if you make the case for the union, you have to do it positively in terms of the various institutions and parliaments and administrations in the UK cooperating and collaborating, so that that's is the Brown theory is that's the way you convince voters in the middle ground not to go for independence when it comes to it, because they see that the union is a collaborative effort. My view is that only gets you so far, and that the story of the last 6 or 7 years since the independence referendum in 2014, which the unionist side relied on what was termed Project Fear, I tend to call it Project Reality, which was Alistair Darling and others pointing out the financial reality of Scotland benefiting from large fiscal transfers, which I don't dispute or disagree with. The union is a collaborative enterprise. It involves sharing at various points in its history. Scotland has subsidised England, particularly during the oil boom. These things come and go. But the unionists have been terrified of pointing out the financial reality. So one of the big things about the next few years is going to be trying to find a language and a way of talking about the financial practicalities of breaking up the UK and just how dangerous that is. I thought the most interesting piece of polling was in the Sunday Times, after the election, which was a finding where they had asked 16 to 35-year-olds, are you in favour of independence? And on one level, this is terrifying for unionists. 61% of that age group were in favour of breaking up the UK, leaving the UK. If you then put to those same voters, would you vote for independence if your household was going to be £1,000 a year worse off? The number falls in half to 31%. So it seems to me pretty clear, pretty obvious now, that unionists need to find a way of pointing this out in a sensible, constructive way. It's not Scotland is a subsidy junkie, but that the settlement within the union is to Scotland's advantage, and that the union is collaborative and does involve sharing and fiscal transfers, and try and make the positive case for that and explain it to people. Mm. So that's how I see things. It's about the unionists have had a narrow escape again and need to think quite deeply about how we keep the UK together.
Mm. And in a sense, ironically, Boris and the cabinet should learn from the divisiveness of Brexit and, if you like, Project Fear from the Remain side, that actually it doesn't work, because I know you've said that polling showed that they would change their mind if they were worse off. But a lot of people in Britain who voted for Brexit were quite aware that they might be worse off, but they still wanted it. Principle went beyond that. So we know that actually humans attach more to the emotional, to the romantic, whatever it is, than the economic. So it shouldn't be a time to really flip it all and just show the very positive sides of the union.
Yeah.
So that it's not that you will lose this, but actually what you're getting from us being together, quite apart from having a fair chunk of British prime ministers and senior members of government. I mean, this is the irony, isn't it? Scotland would lose sort of control of England. I've often wondered I've never heard anybody ask Nicola Sturgeon what it is that she feels she lacks at the moment in Holyrood that she will get from independence, other than sort of, you know, the flip currency, but the power to change her society.
She's a conviction nationalist. So what she feels is it's intangible. So yes, she can make a case that over the course of 20 years, Scotland might end up becoming a bit more like Denmark and might be a bit more productive. But really that's not the heart of it. The heart of it is that she is emotionally a nationalist and just believes that it's perfectly legitimate. Perfectly legitimate view that Scotland could be an independent country or should be an independent country. And I've absolutely no doubts as a Scot that after a 20-year extremely painful adjustment, that Scotland has lots of clever people in it and lots of potential, and I'm sure it could, but I think the disruption would be so severe, and what's then lost in terms of the union being a common endeavour as working together as far as eclipses anything that's possibly gained. Where I disagree with you slightly, Maggie, on the Brexit parallel, and there is a parallel, of course there is. You know, I'm a Scottish unionist who voted for Brexit, so of course I can see the irony. And people in particularly Remainer friends in London say, the same arguments are playing out and you're losing. You should have thought of that when you voted for Brexit. But they are of a completely different order. And so when you're talking about the UK leaving the European Union, there's some trade disruption. You can measure it sort of over the course of 10, 20 years. We'll argue about it. But it's a manageable event, and there is a trade-off. Most of us who voted for it accepted that there might be some economic downsides, but that was trumped by other things which came with it in terms of opportunity and self-government. So of course that applies to the SNP as well, but the Scotland in the union is a totally different proposition from the UK in the European Union. We're talking about a 300-year partnership with a currency union, with nuclear weapons and common defence, with a pension system paid out of current taxation, with a welfare system paid out of current taxation, and 300 years of intermarriage, cultural cooperation. It is on a different scale. Plus, the numbers are so small on Brexit compared to Scotland having a deficit of that size and having a £15 billion black hole on day one.
I think maybe I didn't explain myself properly. I'm not saying it's a similar thing at all. I completely get what you say. What I was trying to point out was that the Remain side got it so wrong by using Project Fear as its tool to try and stop people from voting it. What I was saying is, can we learn those lessons from a unionist point of view, putting it, not doing Project Fear, but Project Positive, actually. The Scots are part of Britain. We're so integrated, as you say, intermarriage. We are one, can we say, one nation in many different countries with lots of different tribes. That's what I was trying to say. It is totally different at all. What I was going to ask is, there's been talk that Nicola is now going to go off all around the EU capitals to talk and try and win them over. Now, I mean, that's the last thing they want to do, because you'll have Spain and Catalonia, the Spanish.
Yeah, I mean, opinions, I think she didn't get a great reception in Germany last time, did she? I think they'll be polite.
Yeah.
The difficulty comes in, for the nationalists, and this is where another area where unionists have got to concentrate, is just explaining how fractious this is going to be and how long it would take if Scotland did get a referendum and then vote for independence. So it's what currency is it using? So, I mean, fine, it might get back into the EU after 5 to 10 years, but so it's going to begin using the pound, using someone else's currency without effectively having a share of the central bank. It's then, so that involves potential for capital flight. It's then going to switch to its own currency, which is perfectly doable, and it's then going to have a discussion about maybe joining the euro after it's joined the EU. So over the course of 10 years, you're saying to Scots that they are going to have not only a massive hole in public spending and a huge deficit, which would require, well, what would it require? Big spending cuts, and I don't think tax rises would be a good idea, because that would send people with wealth, drive them away from Scotland. And all of that's going to be happening against a backdrop of using potentially 2/3 currencies over the course of a decade and erecting a trade border between England and Scotland. And England is Scotland's biggest market by...
Yeah, it was about $12 billion.
You know,
it's insanity, isn't it? But yeah. Nicola Sturgeon doesn't care about that.
It's, but then it's a big question is how long she will stay there. I mean, she looks exhausted. Will she stay for the full 5 years? That's unclear. Sorry, you were going to ask last question.
Yeah, do you think so? In a sense, it's got to be real soft power wooing. Michael Gove's already talked about, hasn't he? A more direct way of doing the money with Treasury transfers. I've forgotten the expression rather than the Barnett formula. You know, are there things we could do, and are there other in between steps? Because all the polling shows that, you know, you've got a third of the Scots, 5 million, 5.2, who are pro-independence, a third utterly against, and a third in the middle. So if there were to be another referendum, the unionists have got to capture that middle third so that it's a 60% plus next time round. So, I mean, is Boris a liability? Should he go up there every 6 months?
Well, he didn't go up there during the campaign. So
that's a mistake.
Boris, obviously, their focus groups and their polling showed Scottish Tories that he was a get out the vote machine for the SNP. That's why he, to be blunt, that's why they didn't utilise him, because they had told me and various other journalists that they were definitely going to send him to Scotland during the campaign, and it definitely didn't happen in the end, despite their assurances 5-6 weeks ago that it would. So yes, that is a long term problem for unionist politics, is that Boris is dominant in England, in English politics, but is a turnoff to most Scottish voters.
Yeah, but if we know, sorry.
Will Boris still be Prime Minister in 5 years?
Well, yeah, that's another question. But isn't that a bit of a short term? And I want to move on to the London Mayor in a minute. Because just because something is not good at the moment doesn't mean it can't improve. You've got the SNP, who you're not going to change anyway. They're going to come out and vote anyway. But there are perhaps a lot of in-betweeners, some of the Greens. I mean, Boris actually is probably greener than any other, well, professors to be greener. I mean, there might be people he could tip. So I think it's a bit cowardly that actually he's not, and others, big beasts.
Members of the cabinet should just be what Gove is doing is I think the right thing, and there should just be more of them, just
all the time.
As a massive force being seen in Scotland. On Boris, maybe you're right. I mean, anything's possible, but it doesn't strike me as very likely. You look at his numbers, I mean, they're just kind of off the charts in terms of net favourability. I'm trying to think how I can explain it in polite terms. I'm very pro-English. This is not an anti-English comment, but there's just something about him, and it's a character and a persona which appeals to working class England, right? In a that old Tory thing of toffs and the working class, having this bond, this connection, doesn't apply in Scotland, and Boris is just perceived as other and English in the wrong way. I don't see how you fix that.
We shall see. So do you think the Tory central office are now kicking themselves for not pulling out the guns a bit more in London? Because Sean Bailey was not that far behind at all. And maybe with a little bit of push over the edge.
Yeah, though he did. I mean, someone pointed out that Khan's victory wasn't crushing in the way that it was supposed to be, but that he actually won. I think he won by slightly more than Boris won re-election in 2012. Yes is the answer to that, in that they kind of gave up, didn't they? I know there are people working on the Tory campaign who may be listening to this podcast and would deny that and say that they worked very hard, but there was an acceptance from a year ago that just it was not going to happen. Whether that was because the candidate was wrong or just London being a Labour city, but yeah, yes, you're right. I mean, with the benefit of hindsight, if they'd fought a bit harder, it's possible. Though, isn't it interesting the way in which sort of strange parts of the country are now going Labour as well? You're getting this kind of inversion, aren't you? There are partly because of the planning thing. Look at what happened in Cambridgeshire, in Hertfordshire, in bits of Oxford, with people really starting to feel as though, you know, people, maybe those electorates are changing demographically as well as people move out of the cities, but feeling it's almost like we're left behind southeast.
You know, it's
all the attention is on the
Hartley pools and the red walls and I mean, London has, I think it's about half. I looked up the home ownership. I think it's about 52%. So a lot of rent people, a lot of people renting in London, a lot of students, a lot of Deliveroo, a lot of very fragile work. So, and a lot of university students looking for work. So you can see why, and the younger you are, the more likely you're to vote Labour or Green. But maybe there should be more effort there. Now, the green phenomena is quite interesting, isn't it? They got Bristol Council, 24, I think it was. Do you think that's something as people turn off Labour?
As you said earlier, I just think it's a dead end. I just think it's, you know, the Green Party spawned by as a kind of fringe of the Liberal, of the Liberals or the Liberal tradition, now ends up sort of consuming the Lib Dem, consuming and almost destroying the Lib Dems, replacing them in Scotland, where you know, Liberal Scotland. I never thought I would see it, but they only got 4 seats in the Scottish Parliament election, which means they don't get short money and they don't get the proper, you know, status of a proper party. So, and that's because of the rise of the Greens, which and then now of course can be in government with the SNP. Stick by what I said earlier. I think if you want a non-Tory government, at some point, the Labour Party, and it seems a hell of a long way from it, is going to have to get its act together. Shall we wrap things up there? And just if your reaction subscriber, great, thank you very much. If you're listening to this and you don't subscribe to Reaction, go to the site. It's really easy to join. You get my newsletter. You get all of the brilliant journalism by Maggie and our team, including columnists for our subscriber audience, like Tim Marshall. And we're also back, I'm glad to say, doing live events. Actually, on July the 6th, we have our first live event since this ghastly crisis started, and it's with Neil Ferguson, and I'm pleased to say that's the brilliant historian Neil Ferguson, not the other COVID modelling lockdown Ferguson. It's the real Ferguson, and that's at the Garrick Theatre on the 6th of July from 6:30. So the details are on the site. And hopefully you can join us for what will be a fascinating evening of conversation about the crisis, but also all sorts of other interesting things about the state of the world. So until next time, thank you very much for listening.